Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On Friday, June 15th, 2018, 23-year-old Jermaine Charlo went out in Missoula, Montana. She visited a few bars with her ex-boyfriend, and right around midnight on June 16th, CCTV footage shows Jermaine talking with a few guys she knew outside of a bar. Her ex-boyfriend, Michael DeFrance, is in the background. The camera shows Jermaine and Michael walking down the street. According to him, he dropped her off at a friend's house. According to her family, that friend didn't exist. Jermaine Charlo has never been seen again. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Jermaine Charlo. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. This is another case of a missing Indigenous woman. And it's also one where investigators seem to have a pretty good idea of what happened to her, but not enough evidence to prove it.
I mean, the obvious just from that intro is it's the ex-boyfriend.
Yeah, and the way this investigation unfolded is quite interesting and really illustrates the difficulty of a case like this where not only you don't have a body, which obviously presents problems in and of itself, but not insurmountable problems. The issue comes when you have no body and then also no forensics. And that's, I think, a lot of times where we see cases like this, where it does seem that there's, you know, a logical conclusion, but just not enough evidence to make the prosecutors confident enough to take it to trial.
All right. Well, now I'm curious as to the details of this. So,
yeah. And I think this is a tough one, too, because like, there's some stuff, you know, there's not nothing. But of course, that's what we'll be getting into. Before we do get into it, though, we've had a few folks join us over on Patreon. So we'd like to take a moment to give them a shout out. Thank you to Carrie B, Catherine D, Lauren T, and Chelsea F. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you all so much.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to get these episodes ad-free and early, you can join us over on Patreon at any time, starting at just $2 a month. So now let's get into the story of Jermaine Charlo. Jermaine Austin Charlo was born on April 23, 1995, to Jennifer Morrigue. She grew up in Dixon, which is a tiny community on the Flathead Indian Reservation in western Montana, about 40 miles northwest of Missoula. She's an enrolled member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. Jermaine often went by Liz and sometimes used her mother's last name, Morrigue. Jermaine was raised in a big, close matriarchal family. I don't know anything about her biological father. He seems to have kind of been out of the picture, but she had a lot of other family that she was raised with. In addition to her mother, Jennifer, Jermaine was also especially close to her grandmother, Vicky. Her aunt, Valenda Morrigue, is only 10 years older than her, and so growing up, they had more of like a sisterly bond. Valenda has really been the one leading the charge over the past 8 years to keep Jermaine's name out there and to help move the investigation forward. Jermaine was, in many ways, a typical 23-year-old. She was extremely online and posted regular vlogs on her day-to-day life. And because of this, we have a lot of footage of Jermaine just living her life and being her funny, creative self. Jermaine could be a girly girl. She loved to dress up and go out with her friends, but she also loved the outdoors. She didn't mind getting dirty, and she loved hiking and fishing. She'd had a job planting trees for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes for several seasons, and she was scheduled to start again the Monday after she disappeared. Jermaine was also interested in becoming a seasonal wildland firefighter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's unique.
Yeah. So I thought so too. I was like, that's like, where did that even come from? But there's a 48 Hours episode on this case. And in it, they mentioned that her ex-boyfriend, who I mentioned in the intro, Michael, he had done that for a while. So I think maybe that's what gave her the idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a show now called Fire Country that's all about that.
Oh, is that what that's about? I've never seen it.
I mean, I haven't seen it either, but I've...
But yeah, so it's like the same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously it wasn't on back then.
Yeah.
So that's really unique. That's cool.
Yeah. So she had an interview lined up to become a firefighter, but she never made it. Jermaine's main passion, though, is art, and she also had a dream to attend the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. And that's just a little bit about who Jermaine was in 2018. But if you were to ask her what the most important thing about her was, she probably wouldn't have said any of that. She would have said it was being a mom. Because Jermaine was a young mother. She gave birth to her first son when she was around 19 years old, and her second son followed 2 years later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so at 23, she had two kids. They were about 4 and 2 at the time. But I find it so interesting. Like, she was clearly in this place of transition. So Michael was the father of her children, and like I said, they had broken up, but... She was really trying to find herself. It sounds like she was trying to find herself outside of that relationship. She was just being a young mom, and she was trying to figure out what to do with her life. Like, she had these jobs. She loved the outdoors. She was planting trees, but she wanted to be a firefighter. She wanted to be an artist. You know, she had so many different facets to herself.
Yeah.
And she just, I don't know, seemed like a really interesting person who was still just young and figuring everything out. So Michael DeFrance and Jermaine got together as teenagers, and Jermaine was just so young. And I think that's just so important to bring up in the context of how their relationship went. Because when Michael's family moved to the area, she was only like 14.
Oh, is he older?
I mean, 16, 17.
Okay.
So at the time, you know, yeah, he's a few years older. So nothing crazy.
Though.
Nothing
inappropriate.
Yeah. So they were around the same age, but he was a little bit older. And again, when you're that young, 2 years is kind of a big difference, right?
Yeah.
So I think there probably was a difference in, you know, maturity levels and maybe even a little bit of like a power dynamic thing going on. But yeah, she was so young. And, you know, I don't know that they started dating when she was 14, but that's when they met. And I think they were friends first for a time, and then the relationship turned romantic. And it's clear that Jermaine loved Michael, and Michael probably loved Jermaine, but their relationship, even early on, was not a healthy one. Even before Jermaine got pregnant, which she would have been like 18 or 19, you know, depending, their relationship turned abusive. In May 2013, DeFrance pleaded guilty to partner or family member assault. According to court documents, Michael admitted hitting Jermaine with an open hand and then twice more with his fist. Jermaine's account in the police report was worse. She said that he shoved her onto the hood of his van, punched her in the ear, the temple, and the cheekbone, and then spit in her face.
Yikes.
Yeah, Jermaine was just 17 when this happened.
That's horrible.
Michael, of course, was of age at that point, probably around 19, and he was convicted for it, but that conviction was only a misdemeanor. However, this conviction for partner family member assault, PFMA, wasn't his first offense. He had another conviction for the same thing, but that conviction is sealed, so it likely occurred before he turned 18.
Probably also against Jermaine.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's no way that we can be positive, but logically, yes. When Michael pleaded guilty to the 2013 charge, he signed a form saying that he understood a PFMA conviction would limit his access to firearms. This will become important later. Though Jermaine's family begged her to leave him, she was young, in love, and, you know, maybe a little scared, too. Though they did break up for a time, they ended up getting back together, and the relationship was just tumultuous and on again, off again for years. Throughout this whole thing, the relationship between Michael and Jermaine's family not only remained contentious, but also turned violent. In July 2014, when Jermaine was over 8 months pregnant with their first child, Michael was arrested for PFMA again. But this time, it wasn't for abusing Jermaine. He was arrested for assaulting her aunt, Valenda.
What the hell?
Yeah, the aunt that was like 10 years older.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't imagine how confused and terrified Jermaine must have been at that time. She was still a teenager, about to give birth to her first child, but she was with a man with a long and documented history of violence. But according to her family, she, like many people in her situation, clung to an idea of a picture-perfect family, like this family she had always imagined. She could have thought that things would get better after the baby was born, you know, whatever justifications you make. But I don't think that this is uncommon, unfortunately, right? You know, you just have this idea in your head of the way things are supposed to be, of the way things could be. And it's so hard to admit that that's just not what's going to happen, even when the evidence is obviously right in front of you. So things did not get better after the baby was born. In 2017, Michael was arrested once again. By then, they had two children, and their relationship had not improved. In this instance, the couple was driving to a Def Leppard concert in Bozeman when they got into an argument. Michael pushed Jermaine out of the moving vehicle, resulting in his fourth PFMA arrest.
Jesus.
And I mean, I don't think he's even 25 by this point.
I obviously don't know Montana law.
Right.
But like, at what point do these arrests become felonies?
That's a good question. I mean, when you have four and one's sealed, one's when you use a minor. So, okay, three.
Three. Yeah.
But I mean, yeah.
Like, at what point is he serving jail time? Does it elevate to a felony? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
Or can you just have a million of these and it's all misdemeanors and no big deal?
Yeah. And I mean, that first one, that 2013 one, I know that he did plead guilty to it. But I don't know the outcome of the other two. So I don't know if it went further than the arrest. I don't know if the charges were dropped, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay. You know?
Yeah.
So after this incident, they separated, seemingly for good this time. But though Jermaine was able to get out of the relationship, it didn't mean her problems with Michael were over. Because remember, they had two kids together, so there was no clean break that could be made. And Michael decided that he wanted custody of the children.
Mm.
And this is why I have to believe that the charges for those PFMAs were dropped, because of what happened when he went for custody. I will say Jermaine was outmatched. Michael hired a lawyer. She represented herself. So, you know, already it's unbalanced going in. But you would think if he had all these convictions, lawyer or not, that would weigh against him.
Yeah.
However, despite his criminal record, which, like I said, that's why I have to imagine that we didn't end up with three convictions, the judge granted Michael custody of their children, giving Jermaine visitation rights.
Oh, that's tough. You know, and she may not have been able to introduce his previous criminal convictions.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it seems counterintuitive because it is against her. But if there's no evidence that he's abusive towards the kids,
right,
she may not have been able to introduce that.
And to be fair, I mean, nothing that I've seen indicates that he was ever abusive toward the children.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's hard to say what happened there. And I think, you know, a lot of it was probably financial. You know, I think maybe she did have that like tree planting job at the time, but she might not have had, you know, a place to live, a solid employment record, a solid income, things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that went into it as well. It was a mess. And Jermaine's family, though, says that, like, even before this was decided in court, he was using the children as a way to control Jermaine and using her ability to see them as a means of control. Jermaine's uncle-in-law, Zach Underwood, elaborated on this whole leverage and control issue a little bit more on an episode of Cold Justice, saying that not only was Michael controlling, but he had what Zach described as a, if I can't have you, nobody can mentality. The temperature is still in the 90s where I am, but in my mind, it's already fall. So I am thinking about Quince's fall and winter options, including their Mongolian cashmere sweaters. These 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters start at just $50, and they give you the softness and quality you'd expect from a luxury brand, but without the luxury price tag. I have a short sleeve one that I absolutely adore and cannot wait to put on again. And that's not all Quince has. They also have premium stretch denim, leather bags and footwear, and beautiful 14-karat gold jewelry that can be the finishing touch that pulls an entire look together. And everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Find the fall pieces you'll reach for most at Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/ATTWG. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/ATTWG. I do love how when we go to the doctor now, technology allows us to see all of our test results, but I'm not a doctor and I don't actually know what most of it means. I have results and my doctor tells me I'm fine, but isn't there more to it than that? That's what I find so cool about Jevity. They close that gap. They don't just show you the data, they act on it. They're the first all-in-one precision health membership. You get access to a functional health expert and longevity clinician who review your blood work and build a personalized protocol. Then the actual interventions, supplements, prescription therapeutics, etc., are shipped to your door every month. 93% of members see meaningful improvement from their first to second round of blood work. I've been able to try out Jevity and they sent a phlebotomist to my house to take my blood and I got so much information that I had never seen on any test results before. So if you'd like to give it a try, you can go to gojevity.com/gone. That's gojevity.com/gone to get your exclusive listener offer of 20% off your purchase with promo code ATTWG. That's gojevity.com/gone, promo code ATTWG for 20% off your purchase. Look, everybody's talking about GLP-1 weight loss medication right now, but what most people don't know is that getting started is so much easier than you may think. Most people assume it's hard to access or out of reach, but BreezeMed changes that. It's medically supervised weight loss that's completely online. No clinics, no referrals, no waiting rooms, just a licensed provider who handles everything.
It's efficient. You fill out a form in under 5 minutes, and if you qualify, medication is shipped directly to your door.
And these are licensed providers. It's medically supervised, and there are no hidden fees, especially with 20% off your first order. And with BreezeMeds, you can get started for $199 a month and it ships to your door for free. No subscriptions, no lock-ins, and no hidden charges. Get 20% off your first order with code ATTWG at BreezeMeds.com. That's 20% off your first order, code ATTWG at BreezeMeds.com. Whether it was because she was trying to make nice or because life and feelings are just complicated, Jermaine tried to keep things on good terms with Michael as much as possible. But by 2018, she was also actively trying to move on. Like she had been dating for, you know, a little while and seeing different people and doing the things that she just didn't really get the chance to do, you know, being with somebody since you're a young teenager, having two kids with them.
Right.
Like now you're 23 and yes, you're still a mother, but now you're single for the first time in your entire life.
Yeah.
And because she didn't have primary custody of her kids, she had free time. So she was out. She was doing things. In the spring of that year, Jermaine started seeing someone new, a man named Jacob who lived in Missoula. She'd been driving into town regularly to see him. And as far as investigators could determine, Michael did not know Jacob existed. Though Michael didn't necessarily know Jacob's name, he had suspicions that Jermaine was moving on. According to Jacob, The day before she disappeared, Jermaine told him that Michael had been yelling at her. He was demanding to know if she was seeing anyone and was saying that he wanted to get back together.
I mean, give it up, you know?
Yeah. But it just seems that he couldn't. And yeah. And he had been dating somebody, too. Like, that's the thing.
I'm sure.
You know?
I mean, it's...
we've seen this before. Control. It is.
It's totally control-based. It's not... I mean, especially at this point in their relationship, it's 100% control. It's not... Like, he's not in love with her.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Like, those real feelings, if they existed, are gone. Yeah. I mean, it's just about wanting the power over her, basically. Yeah. Because, yeah, it's not like, oh, my God, you're the only person I've ever loved, the only person I'd ever be able to love. Like, he was in a full-blown, like, committed relationship with another woman up until, I think, shortly before all of this happened. But, yeah, Jermaine was just, like, this thing that he could not let go of. So that was Thursday, June 14th, 2018, when Jermaine and Jacob had that conversation. On Friday, June 15th, Jermaine came into Missoula. But she wasn't there to meet up with Jacob. She was there to meet up with Michael. Investigators have never been able to establish exactly why they decided to meet up or what they talked about that night. But over the course of the night, they hit three or four bars: the Badlander, the Golden Rose, and the Dark Horse. Around midnight, the Missoula Housing Authority surveillance camera picks up Jermaine and Michael in the alley behind the Badlander. Jermaine is talking to two men who they ran into: Nick Rolt, an ex-boyfriend of hers who is still a friend, and his buddy, Eddie Woodcock. Both of those men later told the Cold Justice team the same thing. Michael was not happy. Eddie said, quote, he wasn't very, like, stoked that she was talking to people other than him. When she started talking to us, I just remember him, like, you know, had his arms crossed or whatever. And then he didn't really say anything that entire time, end quote.
Interesting. It's probably safe to assume that he knew who those two guys were.
I wonder if he did know that, like, Jermaine had dated the one guy, or if they were just men who she was talking to and that was enough.
Well, I guess it depends on when she dated that guy.
Yeah, I mean, it had to have been fairly recently.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Because she had already been dating Jacob for a few months, by that point. So, like, but it wasn't when she was a teenager either, you
right.
know?
Yeah. Well, that's where I was going with that. Like, you know.
I mean, I guess it could have been because her and Michael's relationship was on and off. So, I mean, it actually could have been while ago.
Yeah. Which then would lead me to believe that Michael did know them because that would have been in high school.
Right.
But regardless, it sets the mood.
For sure, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, he didn't seem interesting. And then a bartender who saw them out that night also, you know, had something to add. He said that Jermaine seemed uninterested in Michael. Like, just like they were together, but like not together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which, if that's true, it directly contradicts what Michael would later tell police, which is that the two of them were planning to get back together.
Maybe in Michael's mind.
Yeah, I think Michael maybe had some plans, but I don't think Jermaine was involved in those at all. So right around midnight, Jermaine and Michael walked east down the alley and out of the frame of that video. That clip was the last time Jermaine has been seen. As for what happened after that, we really only have Michael's story, and his story has changed. Version one, which is what he told Jermaine's family in text messages in the days after she disappeared, is they got in his truck and he dropped her at the Orange Street Food Farm, which is a grocery store about a 5-minute drive away. And I don't know what made him pick that or why he thought Jermaine would want to be dropped off at a grocery store at midnight.
Yeah.
That I'm sure was not even open.
Right.
But that's what we know about that. Version two, which is what he told police in a subsequent interview, is that he actually dropped her off in a residential neighborhood about 8 blocks west of the store.
A residential neighborhood, not her neighborhood.
No, because this is in Missoula, and she lived 40 minutes outside of Missoula. When he was interviewed by police, Michael told them that Jermaine had asked him to drop her off in this neighborhood because she was staying at her friend Cassidy's house.
Okay.
Which again makes sense when it's late and you're 40 minutes away from home. If you've got a friend nearby, sure. But there are two problems with that story. One is that police have never been able to find anyone named Cassidy in Jermaine's life. No one who knows Jermaine has ever heard of a Cassidy, and there's never been any evidence that this person exists. Two is that police were able to find out what Jermaine's actual plans had been that night. She was planning on sleeping at Jacob's apartment. Jacob was out of town, but told Jermaine that she was welcome to crash at his place, and he lived in the neighborhood that Michael described.
Why is Michael lying about stuff like this?
Well, so he might not have actually been lying about that because, you know, obviously Michael was so controlling and very jealous. Jermaine's family believes that it was actually Jermaine who lied about Cassidy.
Oh, and said my friend Cassidy as opposed to Jacob. Yeah. Okay.
So like that in and of that actually makes sense to me. So I can see him saying, oh, yeah, I dropped her off at this house. You know, Cassidy doesn't exist. But I can see him saying, well, I mean, that's just what she told me. I had no reason to think that Cassidy didn't exist.
Right.
So that part makes sense. What doesn't make sense is if that's what it was, which from Michael's perspective is actually pretty innocent, why did he tell her family a different story?
Right.
Initially, like, why wouldn't he just tell her family, oh, I dropped her off at her friend Cassidy's house?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like her family would care. You know what I mean? Like, they were trying to find her.
Yeah. Seems like he didn't really have his story straight in his mind before he started shooting texts off.
Yeah. Shortly before 1 a.m., Jacob called Jermaine, probably expecting her to be at his house and, you know, wanting to see how everything was going.
Mm-hmm.
The phone rang several times and went to voicemail. Jacob told police that he thought somebody had deliberately killed the call. And later, police were able to confirm that via phone records. That call was rejected manually.
Hmm. Do we have a known location?
I don't know the exact location of the phone at the time of that call, but mm-hmm. we do have location data for the phone later that night.
Okay.
So that rejected call was the last, like, actual activity on Jermaine's phone. But her phone was still on after that. Cell phone records showed that between 2 a.m. and 10 a.m. on the morning of June 16th, Jermaine's cell phone pinged over and over off a tower in an area called Avaro Hill. Avaro Hill is roughly 14 miles north of downtown Missoula on the Flathead Reservation. Now, and this is like a rural area. It's steep, it's heavily timbered and brushy. It's also where Michael DeFrance was living at the time. After Michael said he dropped Jermaine off at her friend's house, her phone sat up there by his house for the next 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it didn't take Jermaine's family very long to realize that something was wrong. Like I said earlier, she was constantly online posting on her various social media accounts. But on June 16th, it was crickets. So that in and of itself was a red flag. And then, of course, you know, I'm sure various family members tried to just get a hold of her, say hi, whatever, and she didn't get back to anyone. When they couldn't get a hold of her by the next day, June 17th, Jermaine's mother called the tribal police department on the Flathead Reservation to report her missing. So my guess is that on the 16th, when they weren't able to get a hold of Jermaine, that's probably when they first contacted Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And when he gave them that story about dropping her off at the grocery store.
Yeah.
And then on the 17th, when they still couldn't get a hold of her,
then they called the police.
Yeah, because I can't imagine they would have called the police without first trying to contact Michael.
Well, yeah. I mean, especially if they knew that that was the last person that she was supposed to be with.
Yeah. And I don't know if they knew that at the time, but again, Michael is the first person you'd want to contact.
Yeah.
So by this point, you know, nobody's heard from her in about a day. They called the police. But if you've learned one thing from this show, it's that reporting a missing adult is never an easy process. And then because we're dealing with tribal land, you have the additional jurisdictional issues on top of everything. Because Jermaine had vanished in Missoula off reservation, they told her that the report had to go to the Missoula Police Department. So the family called Missoula PD to file the report, but they told her that they had to come and do it in person.
Okay.
So on June 20th, 4 days after Jermaine was last seen, her aunt Valenda drove the 40 miles into Missoula and sat down with an officer and filed the report herself. Now, they didn't just sit on their hands for those 4 days. They were doing their own searches and investigation, basically, up until that point. But yes, it did take 4 days for the actual report to be filed in Missoula. Now, a detective was assigned at that point, I think because it had been so long.
Right.
But just a few days after that, that detective left for previously scheduled time off.
Okay.
So it wasn't until June 26th, 10 days after Jermaine disappeared, that the case landed on Detective Guy Baker's desk. Detective Baker would be the lead investigator on the case for the next 7 years.
I mean, look, hey, cops deserve to get leave too. But if you know you have leave coming up, maybe you either assign it to a different detective or have a second on the case that can start it while you're gone.
Right. And that does not appear to be what happened. So I don't know what this first detective really did, if anything. And I will say that once Detective Baker got the case, he did seem to take it very seriously and he really did start to investigate hard. But he missed the first 10 days.
Yeah.
And it's hard to come back from that.
It's a lot of evidence lost in those 10 days.
Absolutely. But like I said, Detective Baker did hit the ground running. And within 8 months, multiple agencies, including Missoula PD, the Missoula County Sheriff's Office, Flathead Tribal Police, the Lake County Sheriff's Office, and the FBI, logged more than 2,000 hours on this case. There were around 15 searches, half a dozen search warrants across Missoula and Lake counties, and more than 50 witnesses were interviewed. And this is in addition to the informal and volunteer searches that the family had been doing. On June 27th, after getting Jermaine's phone records and finding that her last pings were in the area where Michael DeFrance lived, the Missoula County Sheriff's Office got a warrant for his property.
Okay.
So like I said, I
there
mean,
we go.
Things started moving quickly.
Yeah.
But you just had this 10-day period of...
Yeah, where yeah. Michael could have done any number of things.
Yeah.
Could have, I mean, obviously, he had plenty of time to clean up any evidence that of a murder. He could have moved her body. Like, all kinds of shit could have happened.
Right. So this warrant allowed them to search for Jermaine's belongings, specifically her phone. So, you know, again, the search warrant seems like it was pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And because it was based on the fact that her phone had pinged there.
Yeah.
So they did the search, of course, did not find her phone. What they did find was a .357 revolver and a box of ammunition in the console of Michael's truck.
That he's not allowed to own because of his previous conviction.
Yeah. They also found two .22 rifles under the back seat. After that search, detectives interviewed Michael again. And once again, his story changed. Now, he said that Jermaine had accidentally left her phone in his truck, and he hadn't realized until he got home. Which, on its face, is plausible. I mean, it's not crazy for somebody to leave a phone behind in a truck.
Okay, but he didn't mention that until... How many days are we?
Yeah, I
into
mean,
this?
We're about probably 2 weeks into it,
yeah,
by this point.
Bullshit.
Missoula County Deputy Attorney Brittany Williams told 48 Hours, quote, in a subsequent interview, Michael provided a statement that she left her cell phone and he attempted to go through her cell phone and he was unable to get into her cell phone, end quote.
Okay.
So, like, again, but that part of the story seems plausible. Jermaine accidentally left her phone and Michael, being a toxic ex, tried to get into it. That
sure
explains why it was by his house all night. And the fact that it was turned off or, you know, whatever the next morning could have just been explained by the battery dying.
Yeah, but okay. Yes. But again, why not mention that to anybody for 2 weeks while
right
there are searches going on for her?
Right. And it also doesn't explain where the phone was now.
Right.
Now, mind you, Jermaine's family had contacted Michael pretty quickly after her disappearance. Like I said, I would be willing to bet on the 16th. And he mentioned nothing about the phone. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, hey, yeah, don't know where she is, but she accidentally left her phone in my truck. And he made no attempt to get the phone back to them. Instead, he told investigators that on June 18th, 2 days after he allegedly dropped Jermaine off, he threw the phone away.
Why? Why would you do that?
He never says why, but not only did he throw the phone away, I mean, he didn't throw it away in the trash. While he was driving in Idaho, he was working as a truck driver at this time. So while he's driving in Idaho, he says he threw Jermaine's phone out of the window at mile marker 94 on Highway 12.
Because that's a normal thing to do.
Right.
This guy's such full of, full of shit.
Yeah. Law enforcement searched the area, but of course never found the phone. Cold Justice investigator Steve Spagnola raised an interesting related point. So later that night, so basically in the early morning hours of June 16th, right after Michael had allegedly dropped Jermaine off at her friend's house, he sent her Facebook messages saying that she had walked off into the dark. But if Jermaine had left her phone in his truck, like, who was he sending these messages to? He knew that she couldn't get them.
When did he send them?
That night, like later that night.
Well, I mean, he did say that he didn't realize her phone was in his truck until
after he got home, but he didn't say like the next morning.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. I'm not trying to defend the guy by any means. Like,
and especially, you know, you look at that the last actual activity on the phone, which was around 1 a.m. when that call from Jacob was rejected. His story is that he dropped Jermaine off just after midnight.
Right.
So
either at a grocery store or in that neighborhood.
Sure. But it was just after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that call was physically rejected, meaning somebody had that phone in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
According to his second story, it wasn't Jermaine because she accidentally left her phone behind.
Right.
So he had to have physically rejected that call at 1 a.m. and then also sent her Facebook messages that she couldn't read. Now, with all of that said, we have to make it extremely clear that Michael DeFrance has never been publicly named a suspect in Jermaine Charlo's disappearance by police.
Is he listed as a person of interest, at least?
Everybody in law enforcement who has been interviewed about this case is very careful about the words that they use and what they don't use. But, you know, there were a few interesting court filings in the first couple months of the investigation. On August 1st, 2018, Detective Steve Diebert of the Missoula County Sheriff's Office applied for DeFrance's Google location history, stating that he had reason to believe the crime of unlawful restraint had occurred.
Kidnapping.
Yep. The next day, August 2nd, he applied for another warrant on the Avaro Hill property. That warrant application asked to, quote, visually observe and simultaneously video record by ground or air at any time of the day or night the outside of the premises, including all grounds, end quote. It also asked for thermal imaging of the property. The warrant was approved by a judge, but police have never released the results of that search. So, yes, he's never publicly been named a suspect, but
they're zeroing in on him.
2 weeks,
yeah,
they are applying for some very specific warrants.
Mm-hmm.
On October 2nd, 2018, police searched the residence again. They found the same .357 revolver from the truck sitting on a desk by the front door and two rifles in the bedroom. Which, okay, so they didn't arrest him 2 weeks or a month or whatever
or
confiscate them. When they originally found them in the truck, and mainly because that was outside of the scope of the search warrant they had at the time whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did nothing. But that still wasn't enough for Michael to be like, oh, shit, let me get rid of these guns.
Or hide them better.
He just left them out. And so when they did get a search warrant that was presumably targeted toward these guns, they were there and they were able to take them.
Did they arrest him at that point, at least for the possession of the firearms?
Yeah, because, you know, like you pointed out earlier, because of his 2013 assault conviction, DeFrance wasn't legally allowed to have those guns. So that became a federal case because that was a federal law that he broke at that point. And that federal case became the only charge anyone has ever managed to make stick to Michael DeFrance, at least for a while. But before we get into the federal gun charges, I want to make it clear that investigators weren't only looking at Michael in terms of Jermaine's disappearance. Yes, he was the last one with her, but he could have dropped her off, like he said, and something could have happened to her after that. They, of course, had to look into Jacob.
Yeah.
You know, right. This was the guy she was seeing. This is like where Michael dropped her off, basically, even allegedly. If he didn't know about it, you know about the relationship. Jacob could have done something to her. Like Jacob could have had something done to her. Like they had to look into him. And they did. But they were quickly able to verify that, like he said, he was out of the state that night. And he was always fully cooperative with police and with the investigation. And there were just never any red flags about him. You know, it seems like they were in a newish relationship. There weren't any arrests or any police involvement in that relationship up to that point. You know what I mean? Like, there's just no real reason for them to suspect him other than proximity. And he didn't
have physical proximity
that would make him remain on their radar. So he was cleared pretty early on. But they did investigate him. According to Detective Baker, early in the investigation, police received information that people from out of state were in Missoula at the time of Jermaine's disappearance, trying to buy a girl. And so he thought maybe there's a connection.
Mm.
Deputy Attorney Williams pointed out that people assume Montana is too rural and too empty for this whole thing, but a major interstate runs right through Missoula, and human trafficking is an issue there like it is everywhere.
I never in my mind would a rural place, like it wouldn't.
Like, oh, that can't happen here.
Yeah, that kind of setting doesn't change crime.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like all crime happens everywhere.
Correct. But she did point that out on 48 Hours, so I just, you know, wanted to bring that up. But once they took a closer look at this tip and just the idea of trafficking in general as it related to Jermaine, they didn't find any evidence of grooming or anything else that would lead them to believe that Jermaine had been a victim of human trafficking. In 2024, Deputy Williams told 48 Hours that the evidence developed in the investigation points somewhere else.
And yeah, that, to Michael.
Right. But again, like that is her
very political,
cagey, vague statement that she made. But you could tell, like, while she was saying that, she's like, yes, the investigation points somewhere else. And I watched that episode of 48 Hours, and it's clear that that's where they were going with this. All right, so now let's talk about the one arrest there has been that is semi-related to this case. On July 28th, 2021, gotta love how quickly the federal government moves, Michael DeFrance was federally indicted for being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. More indictments followed for false statements on firearms purchase forms at a pawn shop. In April 2023, a two-day bench trial before U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen ended in conviction on all counts. In September 2023, Michael was sentenced to 21 months in federal prison plus 3 years supervised release. Jermaine's family was in the courtroom. While they were happy to see Michael face at least some consequences for his actions, they said it wasn't enough. The gun charge got Michael off the street, but it didn't bring them any answers in Jermaine's case. And it just wasn't even related enough that, like, the evidence from that could help them in Jermaine's investigation, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But whatever sense of accomplishment Jermaine's family did feel was short-lived. On December 30th, 2024, the Ninth Circuit threw the possession conviction out.
How?
This is crazy. Federal law bans people convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence from owning guns. To qualify, the state conviction has to necessarily involve physical force. Montana's partner or family member assault statute is broader than the federal standard. It also covers causing emotional distress, not just physical injury. So this is getting a little confusing, but under a legal doctrine called the categorical approach, judges can't look at what a defendant actually did, which in this case was clear-cut physical abuse, because this is based on the 2013 conviction in which he pleaded guilty and admitted to hitting Jermaine both with an open hand and with a closed fist. The judges can only look at what the statute theoretically covers. And because it's theoretically possible to be convicted under Montana's law without physical violence, a Montana PFMA conviction doesn't count federally.
That is such a crock of shit.
Isn't that wild? So that means that even though Michael previously admitted on the record to punching Jermaine, the judges said they were barred from considering that. And this is really a textbook definition of someone getting off on a technicality. The panel didn't want to throw out the conviction.
Right.
But they were legally bound to do exactly that.
This is what lawyers get paid for.
Montana's lawmakers were trying to help victims of domestic abuse
by broadening it. Yeah.
Exactly.
To include emotional abuse.
Right.
Yeah.
Which would, you would imagine include stalking, harassment, mm-hmm. things that it is so hard to get police involvement on in general.
Yeah.
They were actually trying to do good. And they did, because in Montana, you can still be arrested for those things. But
in this particular case, it backfired.
Yeah, because they accidentally created a loophole that hands guns back to domestic abusers. Throughout all of Michael's battles in federal court, Jermaine's family continued their efforts to find her. In October 2018, her family and the CSKT Tribal Council put Jermaine's face on a billboard on Highway 93. It's still up, and it faces Avaro Hill. Jermaine's family has said that they hope her children see it so that they can remember their mother. And because Jermaine was so online, the pictures of her on that billboard are from the day she went missing. She had made a video earlier that day, and so they took screenshots of that. So it has her in the outfit she was wearing when she went missing. By 2021, the family was fed up with the lack of progress in Jermaine's case. In March, they held a protest outside the Missoula Police Department. Jermaine's sister, Chayla Russell, told MTN News they were tired of waiting and they wanted an arrest. Quote, "It's been almost 3 years since her disappearance, and it's not fair to our family," end quote. So remember how I talked about all that CCTV footage in the beginning of the episode?
Mm-hmm.
That footage we can talk about now, but it wasn't actually made public until October 2024.
Why?
No idea. So police gave it to 48 hours so that 48 hours could do that episode. And that was the first time it had ever been seen by anyone, including Jermaine's family.
I don't understand why they wouldn't have released that earlier.
I don't either, because
it's not incriminating to Michael.
Well, no, and it's not like...
And it's not like he didn't know he was a suspect.
That's what I mean. It's like you can understand it if they didn't want Michael to know that they were looking into him or whatever, so they don't want him to know that they have him on video with her.
Well, but he never denied
being with her. Exactly.
So that video doesn't show anything that he didn't already admit to.
Exactly. I cannot for the life of me think of a single investigative reason that you wouldn't want that to be public. And when you watch the episode of 48 Hours, which, I very much recommend that anyone listening to this does, they're like, yeah, well, we think it's really important to release this now so that people can see it and help us.
How many years later? How many years later?
Six.
Yeah, that should have been released.
Seven, I think, by the time it was aired, because they shot it in 2024. I don't think it came out till 2025. It was unbelievable. Again, this video shows the last known footage of Jermaine. It shows who she was with, what she was wearing, how she was acting, how Michael was acting. Like, it gives you a lot of context. And people who were out and about in Missoula, because again, it's a Friday night in Missoula.
Might have seen
like,
something.
Yeah, they could be like, oh yeah, I remember seeing that couple. Like, I remember that girl in that hat. But 6 years later?
Yeah, you're not going to remember that.
In January 2025, the Roxy Theater in Missoula screened that footage for the community. Her aunt, Danielle Mott, said that what struck her watching it was how bubbly and friendly her niece looked. And again, I just, like, not even letting the family of a missing person see footage of their loved one like that just seems unnecessarily cruel. When Cold Justice aired their episode on the case in 2025, their investigators said they were confident the family would get answers soon. And they did work with like the actual police investigators when they did that episode. And that's kind of what they were basing that on. But the answers haven't come yet. In December 2025, after 35 years with the Missoula Police Department, Guy Baker, the lead investigator on this case, retired. He's since started his own investigations and consulting company and has been working with Indigenous communities on search training. But he's no longer on Jermaine's case. Though Detective Baker is gone, Missoula PD says the investigation remains open and active. As for what happened to Jermaine Charlo, different theories have been investigated and ruled out. But all the way back in 2018, Detective Baker told reporters, quote, "I believe that she's the victim of a criminal act. I don't believe she committed suicide on June 16th. There are people who need to come forward and share what they know because somebody did something to her." End quote. To investigators, it seems that the question isn't what happened to Jermaine, it's what can we prove happened to Jermaine. And it just seems like, short of finding her body, they just feel like they don't have enough evidence to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, what evidence they do have, it seems pretty circumstantial.
Right.
Yeah, her cell phone was up there, but even his bullshit story, that's not evidence that a crime took place.
It's certainly not a murder.
Right. And that's really the only thing that they have. Yeah, he had guns, but because they took so long to investigate, it's not like they did a GSR test on his hands.
Yeah, but even then, he could have explained, well, I was target practicing.
Yeah, you know? Totally. It's all circumstantial.
Yeah.
But they don't even have that. Because
but yeah, if there were blood on the guns, if there were any sort of physical evidence like that on the guns, then
that's different.
Yeah, and that very much could have been gone by that point. In Navarro Hill, where he lived, that area has been searched for 8 years. And like I said, it's steep and thick and huge. And cadaver dogs and thermal imaging and hundreds of volunteers have all come up empty.
You also said he was a truck driver.
He's a truck driver.
So he could have taken her anywhere.
Yeah. And he said he was in Idaho, you know? Like, he could have been anywhere.
Yep.
Police at this point have no body, no crime scene, and no murder weapon. If there even is one, we don't even know if a weapon was involved. What they have is a guy who changed his story and has acted incredibly shady. Maybe that, combined with his history of violence against Jermaine, could be enough, but it doesn't seem like prosecutors have wanted to take that gamble up to this point. Even though this story is about Jermaine, it's also bigger than her. In Montana, Indigenous people are about 6% of the population, but roughly 24% of the state's active missing persons cases. More than 4 in 5 Native women experience violence in their lifetimes. But there's no complete national database, which is exactly why like these numbers vary so wildly. Jermaine's case has become one of the faces of the MMIP movement in Montana and has gotten a ton of attention over the years, both local and national. But they still haven't been able to bring her home. If this is what happens with all of that attention, just imagine what happens to the majority of victims who aren't talked about this much. Valenda has said that she'll never stop looking and that she wants other families to know it's okay to keep pushing and keep saying their person's name out loud. As for Jermaine, police just need that one piece of information that can bring everything together and finally lead to justice. Jermaine Charlo has been missing from Missoula, Montana since June 16, 2018. She is a Native American female with brown hair and brown eyes and is an enrolled member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes of the Flathead Reservation. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5'9" tall and weighed around 130 pounds. She has pierced ears, a tattoo of a flower in the center of her chest, and a tattoo of a deer on her left shoulder blade. She was last seen wearing a gray hooded sweatshirt with a brown Under Armour logo, a white t-shirt, jeans, square-toed cowboy boots, and a blue baseball cap with a tan bill and a logo of three trees. Jermaine was 23 years old when she went missing. She would be 31 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jermaine Charlo, please contact the Missoula Police Department at 406-552-6300. You can also submit a tip to the FBI at tips.fbi.gov or by calling 1-800-CALL-FBI. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!